added 156,000 jobs in September.
Well, a September jobs number missing the estimates.
Overall, this is kind of a steady Eddie report.
We have an overall economy that's growing pretty slowly and a job market that, whether Goldilocks or steady as she goes, however you want to characterize it, is much faster, doing much better than the rest of the economy.
How very anemic the recovery is, and the fact that it looks like it's actually slowing down from something that's already got a one-point-something handle for GDP growth.
I think this economy is stuck. I think, you know, the best-case scenario is we get back to 2.25% growth. The reality is we've downshifted this year from 2.25 to 1.5.
You know, we're acting like this Fed has this agenda that they're trying to get toward. Maybe they don't have an agenda. Maybe they just don't know what the hell they're doing. I think that's the case.
Hey, listen, my man, I'm with you. I'm with you. I mean, they're like a rudderless ship.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, on this Friday, we hope if you're along the southern east coast of the United States, you are dry and safe. Please listen to your governors and state officials, because hurricanes are no fun and they can do a lot of damage. It's not just damage, but they also can take lives. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Jonathan Krinsky will be joining me in Hour 1. Jonathan is still very bullish on the stock market, and despite all the worries that we typically get around this time of the year, September and October, there really hasn't been much of a correction. What's more important is what stocks are doing well. You want to hear what Jonathan has to say. Ned Schmidt will be joining us also later on in the latter part of the program. He'll be talking about gold. He thinks it's bottomed. He was talking about a correction. He believes that correction has come to pass. And wait till you hear why he tells you why that correction took place and what caused it. That's coming up, along with Ryan Poplava on what moved the markets this week. All of that in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, over the last 7 or 8 years, we've seen various transitions here on the program in terms of favorability, floating from, say, various asset classes of stocks to favorability to gold, out of favorability to gold, and now back in, it would seem, as well as interest rates. How are we going to frame all of this so that you understand what's happening? What we're going to do is take you back to 2010 and look at two articles that Jim wrote back then, Money Never Sleeps and The Great Reflation, which framed where we would be heading now. And of course, we always ask the question, well, now that we know all this, what should investors be doing? And you know, if you ever watch the movie Wall Street, money never sleeps. Money will always find a place where it is treated best. And so you have to figure out where money is being treated best in order to know where to put your investments. There have been a series of passing fads as to where people want to put money, but they didn't always quite reflect the realities of the market. We'll look at all of that coming up today on The Big Picture. And turning to the market wrap chair, voila, Ryan Poplava is back with us. Ryan, we've missed you these last couple of weeks, but welcome back. Anything that really moved the market this week? Any big stories, or did we just get distracted by what was going on in the presidential race?
Yeah, that's always comical, but you know, it's the first week of the month as usual, where the economic numbers are fairly important, especially obviously the jobs report number. And typically we look at the manufacturing and services ISM numbers on top of that jobs report. And, you know, this area was weak when it was announced last month. So we were talking about August's data, which really kind of curbed speculation the Fed would raise rates in September. So we were kind of looking to see, what was it going to do this time? And it looks like the employment data this week has lowered the chance for a November hike. You know, it wasn't a big jump. In fact, it was a slight drop. Yet it was strong enough to increase the odds of a December hike. You know, we continue to hear from Fed governors that they want to raise rates this year, again, so that they can lower them if we get into a recession. But, you know, current estimates for a rate hike in December, just looking at the Fed futures contracts, is showing a probability that has gone up as of this week to 63%, with November really, John, barely on the radar at 10%. That did little to change the S&P very much this week, didn't influence it all that much with the jobs report on Friday. So the S&P did finish the week down to 2153. down almost 0.7%. But speaking of returns, John, I was just looking at what typically we have to deal with in October from a seasonal standpoint. And looking at the Stock Traders Almanac, the S&P 500 is typically down, there it is, 0.7% on average in an election year. So we're right there in the first week.
Okay, well, the ISM numbers were down for August, and then if you look over at the jobs report for August, I mean, that really downplayed any kind of a Fed movement. How are the ISM numbers for September?
Well, manufacturing ticked up, right where we left off last month. It had ticked just below the neutral level at 50. It was around 49, I think, 0.8, ticked up to around 51.5. Services, however, had a big jump. There was a pretty decent correction in August, very decent jump in September, up to 57.1 from 51.4. So like I said, big jump there. The services number was solid, but it didn't seem to influence the market too much when it was announced on, I think it was Wednesday. I think that's because, again, all the investors there on Wednesday were still waiting for the jobs report later in the week.
So what else moved the market this week, Ryan? I mean, we had heard there was a lot of big movement in the British pound on Friday, but I hadn't heard why. I think Ned Schmidt's going to address that a little later here on the program, but go ahead.
Lots of reasons. No one can ever point to one single one, but I think the currency, bond, and commodity markets all kind of told two different stories this week. Rather, I should say subjects, which was the Brexit topic and separately higher rates are coming. So let's talk about each one of those. There was an official announcement on Monday from the UK government that it plans to trigger Article 50. They had the vote, did the poll, got the votes. They're going to exit the UK. Now, how do they officially start to do that? Well, they address it with this Article 50, which is the formal mechanism to leave the EU. And they're going to address that. They want to at least address that by the end of March next year, with their goal being to eventually leave the EU by April of 2019. What this basically does is it starts a negotiation process. So this week's announcement to officially trigger that Article 50, it reports the ECB is thinking about ways to taper its asset program. Both of those subjects really caused the bond market and rates to really fluctuate. Rates went up and the pound started to break some real key technical levels. Interestingly, François Hollande, French president, indicated on Friday that his feelings about the UK, he has some pretty big misgivings. He said the UK needs to pay a heavy price for leaving the EU. And he's looking at just the contagion here. If the UK wants to leave, then a whole list of other countries are going to do the same thing. So he's obviously going to fight for the EU, jumped up to that today. And it's believed that his message was also a factor in that big drop in the pound. Like you mentioned, it was big. The technical damage on top of Hollande's warning led to what's now being called a flash crash in the pound on Friday, which started in Asian market trading at the beginning of the day. It got down as low as 6% and was being looked at as, I think it was a three-decade low for the pound, before it did eventually rally throughout the rest of the trading day in other markets back in Europe and then here in the US with our financial markets participating. But interestingly, Chancellor Hammond came out, and also I think Draghi as well. We started getting all the big names to get out there and prop things up. Chancellor Hammond blamed the move on short-term technical factors, saying markets go up and down. Sage advice there. The man's an adept student of the markets. Clearly a monk of sorts, right? No, but seriously, John, have you seen the chart for the pound versus the dollar over the past 2 years?
Yeah.
It doesn't take a real student of the market to see that's no short-term pattern or noise. That's a trend.
Well, it sure is, but, the pound weakness seemed to help the UK stock some this week. And it's always interesting to me, by the way, when you get into these international agreements, you have to understand, they always come with this, what I call a smiley fist. And it's, you can join the European Union, come over. And if you ever want to leave, that's okay with us. We let you leave. We have a little clause here. You can trigger this one.
That's fine.
But what they're trying to do is be vindictive about it, because they realize it jeopardizes an already 10 relationship. It's almost like I've been predicting, if California's taxes ever got more abusive, that they would begin penalizing people who left. How dare you leave our taxing area, you know, in favor of something else and try to have an exit tax or something like that. But, you know, as I said, the pound weakness seemed to help the UK stock some this week. The London Times Index was up 2% from last week. And by the way, next week, earnings season begins with Alcoa reporting Tuesday morning, CSX Wednesday, and a few banks like JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, and Citigroup on Friday. So besides earnings, Ryan, anything else you want to add for the weeks ahead?
I think the bigger picture, obviously, the central bank is an important factor in the markets for the past, 7 years? There was some rumblings this week in that central bank sphere as we continue to see Fed speakers reiterate they're feeling confident in the economy enough to raise rates again this year at some point. You got Evans, Mester, and Lacker off the top of my head pretty much said as much. And as I mentioned, there was some discussion earlier in the week that the ECB is finally looking at tapering options for its purchase program. You know, what do they do? You know, they've got dates set. When do they start to first stop the purchases and then eventually stop reinvesting? Like, we're still reinvesting in mortgage-backed securities, etc. But the ECB September minutes did also come out this week, later in the week, from that discussion about the ECB tapering, and basically showed that there was no discussion of such. Then on Friday, Draghi came out, president of the ECB, to reassure markets, as I said, which is his usual MO, prepared to do whatever it takes and use all tools at his disposal sort of speech. But I think through all of the noise, investors need to really seriously start looking at the two sides of the yield curve coin. So if rates are expected to go up, we have been seeing weakness in yield sensitive areas, right? Makes sense. Consumer staples, high dividend payers, basically typically there. Bonds, utilities, REITs all have done exceptionally well over the many years with rates falling. And then now we're seeing on the flip side of that coin, if yields are going up, where's the strength? Typically in financials. So tying that into the earnings season next week, you know, Friday should be a big day with the financials, right? Three banks reporting, but also seeing the 10-year treasury, the yield itself has been going up as the 10-year treasury bond itself has been going down in price. And the yield was testing its 200-day average this week, right around 1.75%. So the yield steepening trade is once again at investors' feet, just like it was at the end of last year. And it's funny, there was a lot of prognosticating happening at the end of last year that rates would continue to just spike and skyrocket, and they did anything but after the Fed raised interest rates when that cold winter hit again and we start dealing with some bad economic numbers. So it's anybody's best guess after December, if they do raise interest rates, that yield steepening trade, it will stay on. I guess it all depends on the weather.
So it would seem, and of course, weather is the big topic this week with everything going on in the Caribbean and up the east coast of the U.S. But Ryan Poplava, good to see you back again. And things will be hopefully interesting this fall. How does that sound?
It will. And like I said, over the next few weeks, we'll have earnings. So that will be definitely something different to talk about than central bank and Brexit stuff. So looking forward to it next week.
Okay. See you then.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at FinancialSense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Alan Cole. He's an economist with the Center for Federal Tax Policy at the Tax Foundation. Alan, let's get into what we know about the New York Times article, because it's my understanding they didn't have the entire tax return. But let's talk about the facts as we know them.
Right. What the New York Times was mailed was just a few state tax returns and just the first page of each of those. So there's very little in the way of detail. It's just kind of a 30,000-foot overview of Donald Trump's finances. And there you see him carrying over this tremendously large loss from previous years. But that's all we really know.
Well, the market started out on a sour note at the beginning of the year. There were predictions we would have a downfall during the summer, just as we did in 2015 and also this fall. But that's not what happened. The market has gone in a different direction. Still positive for the year. Joining us on the program is Jonathan Krinsky. Jonathan, let's talk about where we were at the beginning of the year, and then we had a nice run-up in stocks coming out of February as the Fed changed its tune. Then we got to summer, and there were all kinds of predictions about Brexit and, oh my goodness, take cover. Well, we did get a downturn for a day or two with Brexit, but then everything was up and away. In a shift in a market. So let's talk about that, because we didn't get a summer downturn. If you take a look at where stocks are today, a month later, we're not getting much of a fall downturn as well. What's going on here?
Yeah, so it's been an interesting couple of months. If you were to just look at the overall broad market, let's say the S&P 500, you would think not much has been happening since Brexit, but really nothing could be further from the truth. And what's happening underneath the surface is there's been a massive shift or rotation out of the safety stocks or the high dividend, low volatility, defensively natured stocks that, you know, were pretty crowded as we came out of the February lows and even into Brexit. So there's been a rotation out of those and into the more cyclical, higher beta stocks. These would be your energy, some of your materials, industrials. So despite the fact that the S&P has been trading kind of sideways for the past 3 months, it might be up a couple percent. Really, the bigger rotation under the surface has been more meaningful. And if you look at a ratio of something like the low volatility ETF relative to the high beta ETF, there's been about a 20% spread differential since Brexit. So pretty impressive stuff below the surface. You're just not seeing it at the index level.
Yeah, the other thing, too, is if you take a look at some of the smaller cap stocks, which tend to be more high beta, they're up in the double-digit category for the year. So it seems like, Jonathan, the movement in the market is becoming broader base in addition to be, let's say, high beta.
Yeah, that's right. So we can look at a relative ratio of small caps to large caps. That's been moving higher throughout most of the year. The Russell 2000, which is a small cap index, is still below its all-time highs made last year, but since February, it's been seeing steady outperformance. So that's also impressive. Even yesterday, we saw the microcap index, which doesn't get a lot of attention, but that's even a step below the small caps. That hit a new 52-week high. So yeah, you're seeing breadth broaden out. And I think some other important technical things that we watch to get an indication of breadth is something like the cumulative advanced decline line. So if you look at a measure of that on the S&P 500, the NYSE Composite, the NASDAQ, and the Russell, all of those made new all-time highs within the last few weeks. And then you can look at something like the percentage of stocks above their 200-day moving average. And if we look at that on the Russell 3000, which is 98% of all U.S. equities, as of last week, that stood at about 76%, which was the highest reading since early 2014. So pretty much any way you cut it, there is expanding breadth. And as I mentioned, it's in the cyclical areas. The parts of the market that are weak and that are rolling over are actually the defensive, high-yielding names. So typically, that is a good sign for the overall market.
Jonathan, what is it telling you when we're seeing groups like oil, aluminum, paper starting to move up? What is that telling us perhaps about the economy that we don't yet see?
Well, the obvious implication would be that the economy is perhaps improving or better than some of the macro data would suggest. But regardless of whether that's the case or not, you know, we're more concerned with what the stocks are actually doing. And you want to be in stocks and groups that are showing relative strength and moving higher. Of course, you never know if this is just a blip or a start of a new trend, but you know, we're seeing more evidence that it is more of a sustainable trend. And I think you also have to remember that a lot of these cyclical groups that you mentioned have already had bear markets. You know, you look at the energy and material stocks, most of those groups on the index level are down 40 and 50% between mid-2014 and early 2016. And on the stock level, many of them saw even bigger declines in the 70, 80, 90% pullback range. So we're always open to the fact that this could just be a bounce and the market could roll back over into a new bear market. But I think the flip side of the coin is you have to be open to the fact that the market's gone sideways essentially for 2 years. That in itself was kind of a bear market. And it was just the fact that we had rolling sectors and stocks getting hit. And they didn't all coincide at once. I think that's the reason you didn't actually see, let's say, the S&P 500 see a 20% peak-to-trough drawdown, which is traditionally what most people would consider a bear market.
Let's talk about the energy sector, because we saw very low oil prices at the beginning of the year when oil got down into the 20s. Then we had a quick run up into the 50s. And we've been trading sort of in that $40 to $50 range. On the day we're doing this interview, oil is over $50 a barrel. What about the energy stocks? I mean, they got a nice run, but they've been sort of going sideways too.
So energy is actually now the best sector on a year-to-date basis within the 11 sectors now in the S&P 500. So that may surprise some people, but as you mentioned, really the bulk of that gain came off the February lows, and then it's just been consolidating, moving sideways. So I think the case could be made that there's some room left heading into year-end. As far as WTI crude itself, really we're watching this $51, $52 level. If you look at a multi-year chart, that would kind of be the neckline of an inverse head and shoulders pattern. So again, we don't necessarily put too much weight in the pattern, but I think the trend is starting to shift from more of a neutral trend to perhaps a bullish trend. And then if you were to break above 52, you could make the case for something in the high 50s on WTI crude. But energy stocks, they're really just consolidating. I think you're starting to see a bit more bifurcation within the energy group, whereas most of the names bounced off the February lows. You're now seeing some of the higher quality energy names continue to move higher, where some of the lesser quality ones are not really doing much. So I think it's more of a stock call maybe into year end as opposed to the whole group.
Let's move and talk about the bond market. The Treasury yields have been moving up a little bit here. We're on the day you and I are speaking, 10-year notes are at least above 1.7%. What's your take on interest rates? Are they kind of in a sideways trading range, or can you see them going higher or lower?
From a trend perspective, they're still in a long-term downtrend, and we could have said that at any point in the last 30 years or so, so that's not going out on much of a limb. But if we get down into more of a shorter medium-term time frame, we could make the case that they're perhaps ready to push a little bit higher. As you mentioned, the 10-year has some resistance around the 1.75% area. That's where the declining 200-day moving average comes in. But you're seeing rates, and this is important, it's not just in the U.S., it's globally. And while there's still a lot of negative interest rates, we've seen global rates bounce off the lows. And from Japan, the U.K. gilts are, rates are trading much higher today. Germany, so you go across the board and we're seeing rates move a little bit higher. And really, the call and what we continue to remind clients is that we've seen a bottom and a low in interest rates, but it's really too early to say if it's the low and the major turning point. But I think there's definitely room for them to move higher. And then if you look at what the interest rate stocks have been doing, oftentimes stocks lead commodities or even interest rates. So the way utilities and consumer staples and telecom names that have high dividends, the way that those have been trading, and their very poor relative performance and absolute performance also suggests that maybe rates could head a bit higher. And again, remember, the 10-year is really just back to levels around where it was at Brexit. Meanwhile, these interest rate stocks on a relative basis are much lower than they were at Brexit. So that all leaves the case to maybe we could see a move back up to 180, maybe even 2% on the 10-year. We're not perhaps ready to call that yet, but you know, I don't think that would be out of the question here.
And when we talk about interest rates, let's talk about the financial sector, because so many times in the last couple of years, we've had rallies in the financial sector, especially the banking stocks, on the basis that the Fed would be raising interest rates. And of course, a positive sloped yield curve is profitable for banks, only to be disappointed. So what's your take on the financial sector here?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's really a function of the fact that the bank stocks and some other financials have not been in much of a trend at all for the last couple of years. So it's really just this trading range. As you said, they begin to rally as maybe some anticipation of rates moving higher, and then they fall back into the range. So right now we're at the upper end of the range. They have been showing some a little bit of improving relative strength. I guess the positive takeaway in the last couple of weeks is that they've been doing this in the face of Deutsche Bank that certainly had some very big negative fear swirling around it. Deutsche Bank itself has bounced off the lows as well. But what we were noticing, even in the midst of the worst part of Deutsche Bank's sell-off, is that it hadn't been spreading to other bank stocks. Yes, it had weighed on some of the European financials, but if you looked at some of the credit default swaps, on other European financials, and especially in the U.S., they were not showing the elevated fear that we saw even in February or again during Brexit. So that was kind of an encouraging tell to us. We'll continue to watch those. But for now, I think U.S. bank stocks are okay. But again, it's been a frustrating trade, so it's tough to make the case that they're in a sustained uptrend. I think it's more of just a trading range call at this point.
Let's talk about two different kind of asset classes that trade conversely with each other. And I want to talk about the dollar and then talk about gold, which is finally broken through the 1300 level. Let's begin with gold. Where do you see gold going?
Well, gold had a big move up right on Brexit, and then it was just consolidating above the 1300 range. And before a couple of days ago, you could have made the case that it was a healthy consolidation or a pause before resuming its trend higher. But it was taking a bit too long, and then obviously now it's broken the other way back down below 1300. So our sense is that it's probably dead money for a while here. You know, it is testing its 200-day moving average around 1260. It may try to find some support around there, but there's now a lot of overhead supply between 1300 and 1330 or so. So it would be surprising to us if it got materially back above 1300 in the near term. And then, you know, you look at the gold equities and a similar story there. There's a lot of trading that took place on the gold miners when gold was above 1300. And the fact that it quickly broke below that probably left a lot of longs in the overhead area. So yeah, we think it's probably dead money, may get a bounce here or there, but it doesn't get us too excited at this point on the long side.
And the dollar?
Well, the dollar is interesting. We're seeing certain currencies really move against the dollar. The pound actually hit a new low today, lowest level since the mid-1980s. And the hard part about the dollar index is it's very heavily weighted to the euro. It's about 60% of the dollar index. And the euro is not doing much. So the trend on the dollar itself, I'd say, is pretty neutral here from our perspective, but we're seeing some moves more on the single currency side. Also, the yen, I think, is perhaps interesting. It's not getting a lot of attention. Dollar yen got down to around that 100 level, and it looked like it may want to break under, and now it's reversing back up towards 104. So a weaker yen, I think, has a bit more room to go, and that would obviously help Japanese equities in the near term.
Two final questions. What would you like to see to tell you that this market is moving higher? And conversely, what would you be looking at if you felt this market was going to break and head lower?
Yeah, right now our bias is still to the upside. The trend on most timeframes is higher. One other thing I'll note is that as of the close of September, on a monthly basis, the S&P gave a monthly MACD buy signal, which is a momentum indicator. That was the first monthly buy signal since 2012. And we took a look back since 1950, there's been 12 times when you've had the first buy signal in at least a year. 12 times the S&P has been higher a year later by a median of about 15%. So that's a pretty strong signal from a bigger long-term perspective. To really give us more confirmation that that was going to play out, you know, I'd really like to see, obviously, the S&P make a new closing high above its September highs, and that would obviously add confirmation that the trend is higher. On the negative side, again, so we've seen some breakdowns in the defensive areas. If we were to see the defensive areas not bounce, and then some of the cyclical areas roll over as well, and if you started to see more of the banks roll over, some of the energy and industrial names, then obviously, that would suggest more of a risk-off tone. But I think to put things in perspective, the 200-day moving average in the S&P is still down, you know, 3 or 4%, I believe. So even a pullback to there, while it would be uncomfortable and, you know, not feel great if you were long, I think in the scheme of things is probably not the worst thing. So our work is generally relying on something like the slope of the 200-day moving average. So that's been rising for a few months now, and it would really take a lot more deterioration on the trend level and then on the breadth level to suggest that something more imminent than just a couple percent pullback was underway.
So, Jonathan, if I was to summarize the general consensus, or at least your view on the markets in the days ahead, you remain positive.
Yeah, again, I think from a seasonal perspective, October tends to be actually a pretty strong month. On average, you tend to see a low for the market in the first 2 weeks of October, and then you tend to see some seasonal strength. The other thing we didn't talk about is the election, and election years are a bit weaker on average than most years overall. But yeah, I think we're still pretty constructive here and would expect higher prices into year end.
Well, listen, Jonathan, as we close, if our listeners like to follow your work, tell them how they can do so.
The best way would be on Twitter. It's at JKrinskyMKM.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense NewsHour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
The California Public Employees Retirement System, also known as CalPERS, is the largest public pension system in the United States, and it oversees pension and health benefits for millions of public employees. Unfortunately, it is also massively underfunded, according to a recent report by one of our longtime Financial Sense contributors, Dan Ammerman, who joins us today. Dan, you've done the research, you've crunched the numbers, and you have now shown the projections for what is likely ahead, which I should say is not very pretty. But before we get into the numbers and exploring this topic in greater detail, I want you to give our listeners just kind of a backdrop of what we're looking at, a taste of the big picture. What's the main problem here? Why is this issue so important? And where does CalPERS fit into the larger puzzle?
There's multiple components here, some of which are short term, some of which are long term. And we also have this, what I believe to be major conflict of interest between the financial interests of the Federal Reserve and the federal government and the financial interests of state and local governments and their taxpayers. And that's the reason I ran this analysis, was to put some numbers in terms of what's really going on here. The big picture backdrop is, of course, for many decades, we used to have it quite common in the private industry. Now it no longer is so much, in terms of having what are called defined benefit pension plans, where some percentage of your last few years' earnings are paid out to you, perhaps even on an inflation-adjusted basis for years to come. And these have been very popular when it comes to public employees, members of public employee unions, and so forth, in terms of a way to get a very good income down the road that's not necessarily being paid for by taxes right now. So this is an easy decision for politicians to make. And it used to be that years ago that local and state government could make these promises and they didn't even have to set any money aside to do it, which made it almost pain-free in terms of the budgeting. Now, in theory, they're supposed to be fully funding these pensions as they go, but in practice, they're not really doing that. And where things get just downright fascinating is if we look at CalPERS in particular, and this is quite routine, they're not exceptional in this way, they are assuming that they're going to earn a 7.5% return every year into the indefinite future. And that's on average, of course. They know they'll go up and down a bit, but they're assuming they're going to earn 7.5%. And the issue is that they're doing this simultaneously in this environment, as I know you've talked about many times with your listeners over the last few years, in an environment that is dominated by central banking interventions, where interest rates have been forced to the lowest levels that we've seen in recorded history. So on the one hand, we have all these state budgets and so forth and tax projections and so forth that are based upon having quite aggressive investment returns being realized. And at the very same time, we have central banks pushing rates to record lows, and nobody's really linking those two together other than maybe verbally. So my goal with this financial analysis, using a few simplifying assumptions, is to try to show people just how great this conflict is and how substantial the damage may be, unfortunately, for the state of California when it comes to both taxpayers and potentially the pensioners themselves.
Here we are on Friday. We have a major storm on the East Coast, and joining us from that storm region is Ned Schmidt. Ned, you're in Jacksonville, and you and I were talking just before we went on the air here that what the hurricane, it looks like it's going to be a Category 3, is about ready to hit you, what, sometime this afternoon?
Right. We're speaking at 1 p.m., and the eye of the hurricane will pass us at 2 p.m., and high tide is at 4 p.m., so the combination of the storm surge and high tide is going to do quite a bit of flooding over along the beach area. So the beach areas are going to get beat up pretty bad.
Yeah, because it's looking right here. We're speaking here, I'm looking at television that's showing where it's going to hit, and it's looking like when it hits your area, it's going to be a Category 3. So that's 95 to 100 mile an hour winds. That's pretty strong.
Yeah, and remember, that's concentrated around the eye. Where I'm at, the winds are probably 20, 30 miles an hour now, and they're closing all the bridges because they're at over 40 miles an hour now. And none of the power crews can get out till the winds get down below 25 miles an hour. So anybody without electricity doesn't have a chance for another 3 hours before they even start.
Have you lost your electricity?
Oh, yeah, I lost it at 10:30 this morning. That's 10:30 East Coast time.
You and I were talking about this is your fourth hurricane now?
It's my fourth hurricane. The third one, I went without electricity for 8 days. So if you've never lived anywhere through one of those, just imagine where you had no television, no refrigerator, no air conditioning, no any. You can't run the washing machine for 8 solid days.
So, I mean, what do you do? I'm watching what I'm seeing on television. People are stocking up on water. Gas stations are running out of gas. So are you stocked up and provisioned?
Oh, yeah. When they start talking about a hurricane, I don't wait to 2 days before. I went to the Walmart on Wednesday, and there was not a bottle of water for sale in the whole store already. So if you wait till the storm hits, you're out of luck. So I've been through enough of them. I start 4 or 5 days before the storm gets to get everything I need. As the Boy Scouts say, be prepared.
Well, stay safe, my friend. Well, let's get into the market and let's talk about gold, because it was holding pretty strong there around that 1300 level. And now we've broken below. We've had some big sell-offs this week as we speak on this Friday. We're at around 1254. What's bringing the weakness in gold prices and silver in your estimation?
Well, the one that's particularly important right now is what happened on Tuesday. That was the 5th. That was the day that the Second Battle of Britain began. And to back up what happened, Prime Minister May of the UK said she would trigger Article 50 of the EU treaty in March. She also went a step further and told the banks that there would be no special deals for the banks, that banks were not a priority of the UK government. Well, on Tuesday, this lobbying group called, it's one word, the Citi UK, which is the lobbying group for the big banks, issued a report that England would lose 70,000 jobs, £10 billion in tax revenues, £40 billion in revenues. At the same time, the banks launched a major attack on the pound on Tuesday. And I don't want to use the word manipulation. This was an outright attack on the pound by the banks with offices in the city to punish May for that statement. And so that kicked it off. And so all that action on Tuesday started with an attack on the pound by the banks. And it was interpreted by the teenagers trading in New York that this was a strong dollar. It really wasn't a strong dollar as much as a punishment of the pound. That gave us that $40 sell-off on Tuesday. That which has been going on since then has just been followed through on that sell-off the banks triggered on Tuesday. Now, if you've been following the gold market, we've been looking for a sell-off for 3 weeks. And my work called for to buy today. And I've been calling that buy signal for about 2 weeks now because it's been coming. It's not going to jump back up right away because the street is really fixated on this nonsense that the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates in December when there's no reason to expect them. The last meeting of the Fed, the articles all read split decision, narrow decision, could come any time. It wasn't. The vote was 9-3. There's 12 voting members on the FOMC. 9-3 against raising rates. That's not a split decision. In FOMC parlor, that's unanimous because the FOMC does not run on majority rule. It runs on consensus rule, which means you need, not only do you need 7 people to say raise rates, you need a couple more to say I'll go along with that because that's what the majority wants. So this nonsense that the Fed's going to raise rates in December, I don't know where they're getting it, Jim. Maybe you've got a different opinion, but I don't see it.
Our opinion is we've been watching these economic numbers decelerate. You know, the economy peaked in the second quarter of 2015. Corporate profits peaked in the summer of 2014. And, you know, the Fed's goal is this 3% economic growth rate. Then it was 2.5%. Ned, we're in the 1% range. So there's no way that, you know, how could you justify? And here's another thing. How can they be confident they can raise rates when they raised rates in a quarter of a point? And you know the markets will always anticipate what the Fed's going to do. So if we go back to last year, we had credit spreads that started to widen and blow out, especially in the junk bond area. And as soon as they did it, what did we see? We saw 6 weeks of falling stock markets, widening credit spreads, falling commodity prices. How can these guys sit back in their chair with weaker economic data today than where we were last year, lower corporate profits today than where we were last year, and have the confidence to raise a quarter of a point and think everything's going to be all right?
I'm with you on that. And one thing the street has forgotten, and they have to relearn this every cycle, is that there is a connection between financial markets and interest rates. I did the calculation yesterday, and a quarter point increase in interest rates makes it NASDAQ 100, which is the primary center of investment now, the value of that drops 15%. And they're not going to do anything to damage this stock market anymore, and it's already been damaged. And so I don't see them doing it for all the reasons you said, plus others. I think they're basically cowards.
So given this uncertainty that we have in economic growth, and it's not just here in the U.S., the IMF repeatedly has been lowering its global economic growth figures for 2016 as well as 2017, and even the Fed dot plot has done the same. Ned, what is going to be the catalyst for gold then? I mean, you've been calling for a correction. We've got it. We fell below 1,300. We're on this Friday at 1,254. What, in your opinion, is going to be the catalyst? Will it be when we get to December and the Fed doesn't raise, or is it going to be something else?
Well, the something else is any kind of volatility that comes in. I don't know where it's going to come from, but if you look at the handful of things, we've got an election that could go either way. We've got Brexit coming next year. We've got the U.S. and Russia ready for their jet planes to shoot at each other. And we got the economics of China. So what asset are people going to buy in the world? Not just what are they going to buy in New York City, but around the world, the one asset that they're all in agreement on is gold. I mean, if you look at gold demand in almost any country in this around the world, that demand is strengthening, not weakening. So gold is to that point, and has been for several years, where it is now an asset in the portfolio. I mean, I don't know how an investment advisor is going to sit down at the end of the year and review 2016 results and say, and the customer says, where was my gold stocks? Where was my gold and silver? They were the two of the best performing markets last year. And you've got me in Wells Fargo and Apple. You know, I don't know how a manager does that. I mean, the asset to move to is one that has good performance and should likely have decent performance. You're not going to get a customer to add to their holdings of Wells Fargo or Twitter or anything else like that. So I think it's the asset of choice that's under-owned. That's the biggest thing. Now, the one thing we didn't mention on this October sell-off, this is the time of year, October, when institutions book their profits and losses. So a lot of what was going on in gold recently was quite simply people booking their profits, which usually happens in October and is done by November.
Now, I know you follow the futures market. What's the position of the commercials in gold right now?
The commercials have been acting a little better. Their net short position in gold peaked about 3 months ago, and it's just kind of been gradually working its way down. They haven't made a substantial, if I remember right, the number's about between 1 and 2 million ounces. So they've been working it down, but there's been no big reduction or big increase. So they're probably at the point now where we've had a whole year of the prices up. They've got their year made. They don't feel as panicked. Now, we have the same situation in silver. The silver short, net short, is a giant one. It's like 2-1. And so for silver, it's not as big in dollars or in ounces, but in terms of the emotion, it would have been running two shorts for every one long for some time. So they are being less of a source of supply than they had been. And I suspect that we have another 4 or 5 months performance in gold, but they'll continue to let that position run down.
Now, what about silver?
I mean, at this price, you've got to love silver. I mean, it's got a high gold beta. There's no reason for the overly dramatic moves down. You know, certainly the moves down this week in silver were irrational. So I would be adding the silver positions, too. I think silver today is a roaring buy.
And the issue with silver, it tends to be a higher beta than gold. And when it moves very quickly in significant amounts. But also, silver sometimes is looked less as a monetary metal, sometimes more as an industrial metal. What about the impact of that of a slowing economy?
I think that the industrial impact is when you're in a real bear market. The dominant force on silver the last year has been investor demand. And I don't see anything in the economics. Silver is used in electronics primarily. I mean, we don't build cars out of silver or washing machines out of silver. So I don't think that industrial demand on a global basis is any problem for silver right now.
And finally, Ned, let's take a look at some of the other commodities. Let's begin with the ags right now. What's your take on agriculture? The reports I'm reading, we're supposed to have a good harvest, although we've had a nice move in commodities this year. What's your take on the ags right now?
Well, it looks like that the grains have all bottomed. And I'll tell you, and what's been going on is the traders have refused to look at the below the headlines. The headline numbers are always scary because the harvest keeps getting bigger. But what we're doing is we've been shipping massive amounts of grain all year. The Corps engineers reported. Now, for those of you that aren't good at your geography, the Mississippi River runs almost north-south to New Orleans. And you ship grain down the Mississippi to New Orleans for only one purpose, to put it on a boat. The Mississippi also drains the Ohio River from the east and the Missouri River from the west. So the Mississippi River is a giant grain drain. And through the first part of September, we had shipped more grain than we had in all of 2015. The Mississippi River for the next 4 months will set an all-time record in shipping grain. And we work in calendar years. Calendar year for grains, most of the major grains began September 1. We have sold or exported. Our grain exports and sales are up 50% from a year ago. We are shipping grains on barges and trains as fast as we ever have. And that's because we got lots of them. We got high quality grains and the dollar peaked last year. So we're shipping massive amounts of grains. For example, our corn exported. Our exports right now, a month into the crop year, are 70% above last year. Our sales, which is sales that have been made but not exported, are up 90%. Soybeans are up so big, the calculation doesn't make any sense. So we're right now in this massive grain drain that's going to end up, what it's going to do, it won't impact the numbers the USDA reports next Wednesday. But every month from now on, we're going to be showing that ending inventory number is going to get smaller for grains. So the grain markets look like they have all bottomed. Wheat bottomed in June, corn bottomed in August. Soybeans have been the latest trader's game. So they probably bottomed last week. So any problem we got in eggs is in animals. But grains, remember, revenues for these companies in this business and for farmers have two components, volumes and price. And with volumes up 50% from a year ago, now those numbers are going to slow down. But when you start off the year up 50% in volume, it's hard for these companies and these farmers not to have a decent year. And so it's very good in the grain markets, which is very good for farmers. It means things are going to get better for all the companies in the business. And the stocks are up almost 10% this year. And that compares to about 6% for the S&P and NASDAQ. And about 60% of them have outperformed the market this year. So, and I expect that to continue because what this means is this 50% increase in grain volume is going to translate into revenues for farmers. They're going to buy more fertilizer. They're going to buy more pesticides next year. And they're actually going to buy more tractors. So it's actually the environment is starting to be very good for anything connected with grains around the world.
You know, we're seeing a consolidation in this industry. We've got Bayer now making an effort to buy Monsanto. Do you see things like that continuing? I know a while back somebody tried to buy Syngenta. Are we going to be sort of getting down to where you really get down to four or five key companies that really control the world's food supply?
Well, you've got Syngenta is essentially gone. I mean, ChemChina is just getting the final approvals on that, and the stock is priced about 88. The U.S. stock is priced at 88, and the takeout is at 92, so the market believes that one. We've got Bayer going to buy Monsanto. I don't understand that. Monsanto's selling for about 104, and the buyout's at 128. And what that means is we're going to lose two public companies. We won't have Syngenta or Monsanto to trade anymore. That only leaves one standalone company, and that's FMC. So FMC has been benefiting, and it will continue to benefit, being the only standalone public company until we get Dow DuPont. So we're only going to have two crop protection stocks to even own, and so those stocks ought to do well. It looks like we're going to get a consolidation with Agrium and Potash. The bad news is Agrium's marrying Potash. The good news is Agrium's going to run it. We don't want people from Potash running anything. But that merger, the initial response was fairly negative because nobody wants to own Potash or its management. But as people are taking a look at it, they're starting to look beyond the next year, and they're saying, nobody's going to build a fertilizer plant or a fertilizer mine for years. So that means operating rates are going to rise. And what that probably means for Agrium is it's a drag through the next 4, 5, 6 months, and then people will start looking positive at it because people do like Agrium. They do like the management. They do like the retail store operation. So that one is getting a positive view. Now, one of two stocks that benefit from volumes, this 50% increase in grain exports, are ADM and BG. These higher volumes, with the hope of higher prices later on, should benefit ADM and BG. And there are only four major companies in the crop collection and processing industry, and only two of them are public. That's ADM and BG. The other two are Cargill and Dreyfus, and they're private companies. So all of these companies are now situated where volumes are going to be very good this year, and it looks like prices have bottomed. They're going to move up in the grains, probably not dramatically, but that's a perfect environment for them.
Well, once again, you're seeing this whole industry, which is kind of scary in a way. The world's food supply is narrowing with fewer and fewer players in it. Monsanto's going to be gone. Syngenta will probably be gone. Is it possible you could see ADM and, let's say, BG merge together?
I think BG, the possibility, and I don't want anybody to say you and I are saying that BG is going to get bought, but of the companies, BG is the weakest one. And if I were to look for somebody in the industry looking for somebody to buy and get a bargain, I would buy BG and get rid of the management. And BG is the most likely one to be bought by someone, and more likely to be bought by someone that's not a public company.
All right. Well, so the industry's consolidating. Final comments on one other commodity, Ned, which is oil prices. We just dipped below 50. This is a Friday. On Thursday, we had oil prices over 50. What's your take on oil here?
Well, I think that 50 is a little high right now. But if you start looking at the reserve numbers, Jim, if you own oil stocks and you've had a painful experience over the last, year and a half, the next year and a half are going to be better for you. Worldwide oil reserves were flat in 2015. Now, we've had a couple discoveries, but not a plethora of them. So I think worldwide oil reserves are going to be down in 2016, and they're likely to be down in 2017 because the budgets just aren't there. So once you get into 2017, I wouldn't sit around and expect big price moves in oil, up price moves. But the world is getting better for you January 1. And the reserve situation globally is now going to start working in your favor. I mean, Iraq's production will be history by next year. Iran's production will be history by next year, and so on and so on. And Venezuela, you know, I can't believe that anything good is going to come out of Venezuela. And so every day in January, the world looks better for oil stock investors.
All right. Well, listen, Ned, as we close, given where the markets are right now, you think gold has bottomed here. So would you be buying the metals? Would you be buying the stocks? What would you be doing here?
Well, I always start that if you don't own the metals, you got to buy the metals first. The gold stocks have been so good this year, I think you might see some continued profit taking into next month or into the early part of next month. I would be a little reluctant on like the GDXJ, which is the junior miners. That one might be vulnerable to some profit taking. It's done so well this year. So I'd be a little slower on the mines, mining companies.
All right. Well, listen, Ed, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you have two newsletters, one that covers the agricultural sector and one on gold. Tell them how they could do so, please.
I have two websites. One is agrifoodvalueview.com, and the other one is valueviewgoldreport.com. And it's been fun, Jim.
Well, listen, Ned, stay safe, stay dry, and hopefully you'll get power back on within a couple days.
Thanks, Jim. I appreciate that.
Coming up next on the Financial Sense News Hour, we're going to do a special edition of The Big Picture because over the last 7 to 8 years, we have witnessed a transition, which we have described quite frequently on the program. So what we're going to do to go back over this period of time where we've seen favorability floating, say, from various asset classes of stocks to favorability of gold, out of favor with gold, back into favor, also interest rate issues. We'll go all the way back to two articles written in 2010 by Jim Poplava, Money Never Sleeps and The Great Reflation, and look how they were predictive of where we are now. And also speaking of 2010, remember the movie Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps, Gordon Gekko, that whole bit there? Money will find a place where it is treated best, and holding cash even back in 2010 didn't make any sense. The best deals were in the market, and the myths of an imminent stock market crash didn't come true. If it's imminent, I guess there must be a new definition to the word imminent. All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.